Today's program is brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cain5.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And amazingly enough, I actually have a studio in, I have a guest in the studio. Her name is Sasha Stashwick.
That's right.
Is that right? And since I didn't actually do a bio on you, tell us who you are. You're from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Tell us what your role is.
I am. I'm a senior advocate with NRDC's Food and Agriculture Program, which has been around for, it's a pretty new program. It's been around for a good 5 years at this point, I think. And I work on reforming the use of antibiotics in the livestock industry.
Fantastic. Well, that's one of my favorite topics here. As most of my listeners know, it's like I'm kind of like, beating a drum slowly. Been doing it now for 5 years. And actually, it's amazing. Stuff is starting to really happen.
Yeah.
And even in the last 2 or 3 years, I'm kind of like blown away by how quickly it's kind of snowballing. Because when I first started attending meat industry conferences and really, you know, checking into this, first of all, no one in mainstream media was even talking about it. It wasn't on the radar. And secondly, companies, you know, meat companies were like, banish antibiotics from the food? Are you kidding me? Do you realize how much that would cost? Do you have any understanding of what it takes to feed all these people? And oh my God, hysteria ensued. And I am not kidding you. And now it's like, here we had a few months ago, I had Gail Hansen on from Pew to talk about how Purdue has, stopped injecting their eggs with gentamicin, and, Purdue and Tyson both have started reducing their antibiotic, load in their poultry flocks, across the board. So it's really, it's huge. I'd like to see the pork and cattle industry follow suit as quickly as the poultry industry is. But tell us a little bit about what you're doing and why have you guys chosen to fixate on poultry in particular and then sort of obviously move out to the other meat sectors?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me on. And you mentioned beating a drum. And I think it takes a lot of drums beating, and a lot of drums have been beating on a lot of different fronts for really, you know, over a decade now. And you're right. I think we're finally seeing, it feels like something's happening. It takes drums beating on the legal front. NRDC, a couple of years ago, went to federal court suing the Food and Drug Administration, which is the federal agency responsible for regulating antibiotics use across this industry. And we actually, you know, won twice in federal court,
right.
Basically saying, you know, you're the regulator, you're responsible, you have to actually protect public health and regulate use of these drugs. So there's sort of, you know, the fight in the courts. I think there's the fight happening at the federal level. We have, you know, some key pieces of legislation that have been introduced in the Congress. We have...
Yeah, but some of them have been kicking around the PAMTA Act, preservation of, medicine, whatever, Louis Slaughter's thing has been in there kicking around for, what, 8-9 years now?
That's
and
right.
And Henry Waxman had another piece of legislation that he introduced 2 or 3 years ago that was also designed to protect antibiotics from overuse. And really, none of these guys want to vote on any of this.
Well, I think the point is that it takes action on a lot of fronts, I think, is sort of my, you know, my point. It takes time. It takes raising awareness. And, you know, we see action in the courts. We see action in the Congress. We see action now in states, where states are basically saying, you know, we're going to try and pass legislation to regulate these drugs in this industry. And then I think more than anything else, we're seeing a tremendous consumer trend, I think.
That's where I see the real change.
You know, right now, these numbers might be a couple of years old, but I think the antibiotic-free meat is about 5% of the current market, but I think as of 2012, it was it had grown 25% over the previous 3 years. So it's sort of starting from a small base, but it's growing way faster than the conventional industry. You know, we see overall meat consumption in the U.S. declining.
Absolutely.
And I hear from the large meat buyers that I talk to all the time that they see conventional sales either declining or flatlining, but where they really see growth is in these sort of more responsibly healthier more responsibly produced and healthier meat options,
what, like antibiotic-free options. What once was called and still called niche market, but soon to become mainstream, obviously.
Well, that's the hope, is that, you know, I think antibiotic resistance is it's sort of a community problem. You know, we're not going to solve it if 5% of the market becomes antibiotic-free. Yeah. We really need a much bigger, more wholesale change in this industry and in the way antibiotics are used in human medicine, where we've seen a lot of progress too. And so it's not really enough for this to remain a niche issue. We really have to raise the floor across the whole industry so that this becomes standard practice in the industry, so that we're, you know, we ensure that antibiotics are being used safely across the majority of meat production, not just, you know, some small percentage that only some consumers can access.
That's right. You know, you mentioned those two lawsuits that the NRDC brought against the FDA, and you won those lawsuits, and yet all we got were voluntary guidelines. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, the FDA, unfortunately, instead of, you know, taking action and taking meaningful action and, you know, doing what it's meant to do as the regulator.
What we pay for it to do.
They actually appealed those decisions. And what they put out instead were these voluntary guidelines that you mentioned. And so I think, you know, we'll have to see how things play out. But, you know, our concern is that, A, they are voluntary for the pharmaceutical industry and the meat industry alike. And they also contain some really, I think, concerning loopholes. And maybe we should just take a step back and talk about why livestock producers use antibiotics in the first place.
Well, I think most listeners recognize that, you know, most livestock is raised in highly concentrated operations where they're very close together, and disease can spread like wildfire throughout, and plus the sanitation issues are also of concern. And in the case of cattle, for instance, even the diet of corn, which is what most cattle are finished off with, is really bad for their guts, right? So, and so that also contributes to the growth of pathogens within a herd or a flock.
Yeah, so what you're describing is something the industry calls disease prevention. So the idea is basically that the animals are living in conditions that put them under such disease pressure. They're so likely to get sick because they're crowded and stressed and often in really unsanitary conditions. I mean, they're, you know, in their own manure, there's bacteria everywhere, that the antibiotics are being used prophylactically. So it's like,
for,
you know,
sometimes we
joke that, like, you know, we wouldn't put antibiotics in our kids' cereal in the morning just because they're going off to school and could get sick.
Right.
And it's sort of the same thing. You know, the animals are being fed antibiotics every day in their food and water in many instances. And it's to prevent them from being sick. And so this is a routine use that we know, you know, when we go to the doctor and we have an infection and the doctor prescribes us antibiotics, they'll often, they should always admonish us to finish our course of antibiotics.
That's right.
Because the concern is that, you know, every time you use an antibiotic, the bacteria can breed resistance to it. I think what
and
we
you
have
want to be sure you wipe out all the bacteria by taking the full course of your meds.
Exactly. Right. So, but what we see in the livestock industry is that basically many millions of animals a day are, you know, quote unquote, not finishing their course of antibiotics. So one big use is disease prevention. Well, you know, which you mentioned. I think back in the 1950s, farmers also discovered that feeding antibiotics to animals sort of day in, day out also made them grow fatter faster.
Right.
And it improves what the industry calls feed efficiency. So feed is often one of the highest cost inputs into the production model. And so if you can get the animals to slaughter weight as quickly as possible, you know, it helps
money.
Your bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's actually like, you know, there's a lot of literature now showing that, you know, the antibiotics aren't even that effective at doing that anymore, but it became standard in a lot of parts of the industry.
Practice. Absolutely.
And that's called growth promotion. So it's really these two uses, growth promotion and disease prevention, that we're concerned about. And the FDA voluntary guidelines said, okay, you know, you can't use antibiotics for growth promotion.
Right. But and that has to come off the label.
That's right.
Of the antibiotic.
That's right.
And it has to be prescribed.
That's right. But a lot of these drugs are actually labeled for both uses. They're labeled right. both for growth promotion and disease prevention. And our concern, because there is in the voluntary guidelines, there is this loophole around disease prevention uses.
Right.
Our big concern is that you're going to have the same drugs, you know, sort of the same drug use practices
sure.
persist just by a different name. So
exactly.
before they were giving the drugs and calling it for growth promotion, now they'll just call it for disease prevention. You know,
right.
And we won't really see material changes to drug use in the industry. And, you know, I haven't looked at this data for a while, but, you know, FDA tracks, the overall amounts of
the
drugs being used.
Pounds
and,
of drugs,
and
right.
it's trending upward in kind of an alarming way.
Is that right?
Yeah,
we're observed that.
Yeah, we're just seeing more and more drugs being used. It's sort of going in the wrong direction. Is sort
really,
of the point.
Sasha,
yeah.
you'll have to send me some information
yeah.
on that. That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things about changing over the system, because we do, since we do raise our animals primarily in these confined areas. Even if they're the cleanest and you could eat off the floor, you still got a lot of bodies in one small place. And, a lot of meat companies or industry people that I've talked to have said, well, it would cost a fortune to change that model. And where are we going to get the space? And how are we going to do this, without antibiotics? You know, don't you realize we're going to have 9 billion people more on this planet by 2050? And we're going to feed the earth. It's all on us. It's all our problem. But there is a cost associated with using a different protocol for animals. And let's talk a little bit about what that's going to mean in terms of the consumer and also in terms of, say, the contract growers that we were discussing before the show, who are essentially indentured serfs. And, you know, if they have to pay more for their feed, I don't know if they have to pay for their feed. Do they pay for their feed?
So, well, let's just take a step
back.
Let's
talk about poultry, because that's your expertise.
I think when you talk about cost, I think one important thing that gets lost is the cost we bear as a society today as a result of antibiotic resistance.
Right.
So, we're seeing, millions of people get sick with antibiotic-resistant infections every year. 23,000 mm-hmm. people a year die.
Yeah.
And the latest numbers that we put out is that, it costs us about $55 billion a year in lost productivity and sort of hospital costs. So there's
Absolutely.
A tremendous cost to the economy of this public health crisis of antibiotic resistance. And,
right.
This isn't just me saying it's a public health crisis. This is, the World Health Organization
oh,
and
sure.
the Centers
yeah.
for Disease Control.
Exactly.
They've sort of identified it as top five public health crises
yes.
in the world right now. So there's a really, tremendous cost to business as usual. I think in terms of cost to making these changes in the industry, I'll just say that, that there are farmers all over the country that every day show us that you can do this a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. you mentioned, the poultry industry, we have now the third largest poultry company in the country, Purdue Farms. Which has eliminated, they've said that they've eliminated use of medically important antibiotics. These are the drugs that are important to human medicine.
Right.
In 95% of their operations.
Right.
So this isn't, some kind of niche company that you can really marginalize here in this conversation. This is one of the largest,
right.
Poultry companies in the country saying that they're already doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the sky has not fallen.
Right.
Their
flocks have not died.
Yeah, I think especially one reason we focus on the poultry industry is because we think that that's the place where we can see the most immediate change.
Mm-hmm.
The literature tells us that, it's a couple pennies per pound more to raise chicken antibiotic free. That's the literature. I have conversations with meat buyers, from, you know, big mainstream companies that you would have heard of, you know, and they you know, they corroborate that, you know, they're not going to tell me exactly what they pay for their product, right. But they basically say, you know, it's a couple of pennies per pound, you know, sometimes, you know, very, very close to conventional prices. Uh-huh. And, if you just go out into the marketplace, I know Consumers Union, it's a couple of years ago now, I think in 2012, they went out and they did a survey mm-hmm. of supermarket chicken, and they just, you know, dropped into supermarkets all over the country and just took a look at what was available and how much right. it cost. And, you know, they found that, you know, you can find antibiotic-free chicken now.
Sure. You all can around. Buy harvest land.
and oftentimes it's, you know, at a price point that's really comparable to conventional chicken. If not, I think in a few instances they actually found antibiotic-free chicken being sold for cheaper. So I think... the poultry industry, from our perspective, is just a place where we could see dramatic decreases in drug use.
Right.
You know, without, you know, really sort of upending the, you know,
the industrial model.
The model. Yeah. And I think, you know, most of the producers are focusing on alternative practices to just keep the guts of the birds healthy. So they're focusing on things like vaccines and probiotics. I think it's also important to look at just general animal husbandry, you know, giving mm-hmm. the animals a little
sanitation.
Bit more space, keeping the barns a little bit cleaner, you know, things like that. And it's, I think there's just a lot of evidence now, both in the literature and just sort of coming out of one of the biggest poultry producers in the country
right.
that is saying that this isn't just some sort of pie in the sky idea. This is doable and it's happening. Yeah. We're doing it, you know?
Yeah. It did take Purdue, according to their literature, it took them 12 years to change over from injecting their eggs with gentamicin. Yeah. Which struck me as an incredibly long time to work on a project like that, given the short lifespan of chickens, if you know what I mean. It's like they grow pretty fast. I mean, you can go through generations pretty quickly.
That's actually another reason why you can, we sort of focus on poultry is uh-huh. just, you know, the lifespan of a chicken is so much shorter. So you can
right.
kind of like,
you can
make
see.
Changes yeah, sooner. And, you know, Tyson also, just on the heels of the Purdue announcement last year, Tyson came out and announced that they are no longer injecting gentamicin into eggs at their 35 hatcheries. So, mm-hmm. You know, to your point about drumbeat and momentum, I think that's exactly what we're pushing for. And that's exactly what we're starting to see in the industry, in particular with poultry.
Yeah. And the other thing about poultry that I think it's worth noting is that a lot of the new antibiotic resistant pathogens that have come out have emerged from specifically the poultry sector. Salmonella Heidelberg, Salmonella tympanorum, those are poultry diseases. They are not necessarily found in anywhere near the same numbers, correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't seen those diseases being reported. Some of the campylobacters that have come out that are antibiotic resistance also come from the poultry sector more than any other sector of livestock. And I think that's an issue that needs to sort of be addressed a little bit. You know, like, let's talk about why that is. I mean, why are they such vectors as opposed to other animal husbandry issues?
Well, there are certain bacteria that are just prevalent on chicken. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to distinguish between bacteria and antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Right.
I think there's going to be bacteria on all chicken.
Of course.
On organic chicken, too, and everything. You know, I think the scary part is when that bacteria is antibiotic-resistant. And, you know, last year we saw a really large outbreak of Salmonella Heidelberg on Foster Farms chicken
right.
Out west. And it spread to, you know, I think 23-plus states in the country.
Oh, yeah, and it went on for like a year.
Yeah, more than a year. You know, we also see evidence of antibiotic-resistant urinary tract infections, specifically coming
yes.
from, you know, E. coli from chicken. So, I think...
Is that because we eat so much chicken, or is it because it's just they have... That bacteria is more prevalent in those animals because of that, their protocols? Or, you know, I'm trying to, like, pin down sort of why we haven't seen kind of the same explosion of antibiotic-resistant pathogens in other sectors of the meat industry.
Well, I actually don't know. I mean, Americans do eat more chicken than other meats.
Right.
But, you know, we see methicillin-resistant staph infections.
Sure.
Also, MRSA coming out of, you know, being linked
out of pork
to a pork facility.
Yeah.
Yeah, as well. So I think, you know, it's, you know, this problem is not exclusive to the livestock industry. You know,
no.
Antibiotic misuse and overuse in human medicine is a big problem as well. And we see efforts underway in the medical community to improve antibiotic stewardship. I think the point is that, you know, 80% of the antibiotics in the U.S. don't go to human medicine. They go to the livestock industry.
Right.
And so we're just not going to be able to solve this problem unless there's a commensurate push on the livestock side of things. So,
and livestock people say that it's really all about the medical community screwing up. Well, believe me, I have heard so many people point the finger at medicine as opposed to, what do you mean? Only 17. I remember Dick Raymond from, you know, former FSIS undersecretary saying something like, well, you know, if you really want to parse this out, only 17% of the antibiotics that are medically important to humans are going into, you know, into the livestock community. And so how can you really blame livestock for this? It's really all about what we're doing in the hospitals and doctor's offices.
I mean, I think the point is that we have to practice good antibiotic stewardship sort of on
across
both sides
the
of the equation. And
absolutely,
we're not going to solve the problem unless we are serious about it, you know, across the board, like, you know, like you're saying. So I think, you know, to date, we just haven't seen the same kind of push come out of the livestock industry to promote good antibiotic stewardship. And, you know, unfortunately, it's the drug use in the industry is a black box. You know, the companies are not required to be transparent or report about, you know, what drugs they're using for what purposes and what quantities. We're missing a lot of really key data because, you know, the industry is not required to report on it.
But I think that when you look at feed tickets, you can derive that information. That's what they've told me. It's like, well, just look at the feed tickets and you'll see how much is going into what. Because the feed tickets do say if there's antibiotics in those in their rations.
To some degree, but there's still a lot of things that we don't know about, you know, antibiotics use in specific supply chains because they're allowed to keep it a secret.
Right.
Basically.
Well, let's take a short break, right, Jack? And we'll have a little sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Sasha Stashwick to talk more about antibiotics in the food chain and the good news that's coming out of industry.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today I'm talking with my guest, Sasha Stashwick from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and we're talking about antibiotics, my favorite topic, as you all know. I'm just a walking, talking fountain of information about antibiotics in the food chain. But we were having such a cool conversation at the bar before, because we are in the back of a bar here, folks, in case you didn't know that. We're at Roberta's Restaurant.
That's our secret.
And and we'll be repairing thither for an excellent lunch after this. One of the things that we were discussing is kind of the economics and what was sort of the niche aspect of these antibiotic-free or organic meats growing its market share in a big way. And I wondered if you could, like, discuss a little bit about that. And also, you mentioned something about how companies were actually using that as an excuse to mark their prices up, even though the actual fundamental costs of raising animals without antibiotics was not as great as, or at least that's what I was understanding you to say, was not as great as what the markup might have been.
Well, it's hard to tell because, you know, right now, I think part of the problem is that these are seen as niche products. And I think what NRDC wants to accomplish is really raising the floor across the entire industry so that this becomes the norm, this becomes, you know, much more of a mainstream product. I think what we see today is that you go into a grocery store, for example, and, you know, you have a whole aisle of conventional chicken and other meats, and then you might have like one rarefied case off to the side with your like organic and antibiotic free options. And, you know, I haven't looked at any kind of, you know, sort of national data on this, but I think a lot of people's sense is that the cost that is reflected to consumers in any given market is just what that market will bear. The stores are able to mark that product up as compared to conventional meat, just based on what consumers in that market might
That's
pay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to pay more for that.
And I think a lot of consumers are. So that's something that we know for sure, right? We've seen a tremendous number of surveys of consumers that basically say that they want these more responsibly produced, healthier, safer meat options, and they are willing to pay more for them. I think that the idea is that, you know, if and when something like antibiotic-free chicken moves from being a niche product to a mainstream product, you know, the hope is that, you know, the prices will come down overall. You know, our goal is really to make this a product that is accessible to all Americans, to all consumers, not just to an elite few. So I think that, that's really an important part of this conversation, you know, just, you know, raising the floor across the entire industry. I think you'll hear a lot of times from the big supermarkets, the big, you know, sort of large buyers, large retailers across the country that, you know, they offer their consumers choices. You know, again, having this problem solved in a niche sector of the industry is not going to cut it in terms of really addressing the public health threat of antibiotic resistance. You know, we really need to reform these practices across the industry. And a big part of that is having the largest buyers go out to their suppliers and say, you know, we want you to make these changes in the supply chain. The largest buyers in the system have a tremendous amount of power. They can really reach down through their supply chains and really impact practices on the farm. And I think it's really important to, you know, be holding them responsible for doing that. And, you know, you, I think you asked about sort of the companies that
are doing that. Yeah.
And so the fun thing about my job is that I get to talk to a lot of the folks that have either already, you know, made these changes in their supply chains. They were sort of the pioneers, you know, about a decade plus ago.
The
Chipotle's, the Panera Breads of the world. You know, they went out and they really built out these supply chains. And but now you see that their ranks are being joined by a lot of other, you know, big mainstream companies, you know, Carl's Jr., Chick-fil-A recently made a commitment that over the next 5 years, they're going to phase out antibiotics in their supply chains. And so I think what you're seeing is, you know, these sort of big mainstream companies that, you know, everyone's heard of that are making their sourcing practices, they're putting their sourcing practices front and center in their marketing. They're, you know, they are really, you know, telling their consumers, they're listening to their consumers. Their consumers are telling them that they want more of these options available to them. They're responding in a real way. It is having a transformational impact on the marketplace, and they're seeing a tremendous amount of success doing it.
Right.
You can just sort of look at the financial success of the, you know, the Chipotles of the world, the Shake Shacks of the world.
That's right.
You know, these companies are, you know, they're racing to the top in a sense, in a way that I think the traditional fast food industry can only envy. And I think it's really indicative of an important trend, you know, particularly among, you know, millennial consumers, you know, consumers ages, you know, around 18 to 34. I'm kind of like on the high end of that.
Yeah.
But folks that are, they really care about how the food that they're eating is made. They're willing to pay more for more responsibly produced products. They're rewarding these companies financially, with their business.
With their loyalty. That's right.
I think that's, you know,
if that doesn't show the industry what's going forward, the resistance of the conventional meat industry is just mind blowing to me about this. And I can only assume that it is because so much of their product is exported to countries where these are not issues. And I'm not talking about Western Europe, but I'm talking about, South Asia, Southeast Asia, you know, place developing countries where beef is increasingly on the menu where it has never been before. And people are starting to, you know, see that particular center of the plate item is what they want as a center of a plate. They're sort of abandoning and their own typical menus and adopting more of an American model. But what you're saying about these large companies, I think that ties right into sort of why you're on this show today. And that's because McDonald's has a new chief sustainability officer.
Chief executive officer.
And it's going to be... an interesting interlude in seeing where he directs the country in terms of exploiting that trend of wanting more transparency about your sourcing and bringing more people back into the McDonald's fold. Because, I think everyone has seen the headlines that McDonald's is flatlining. And what this guy does is going to be really interesting going forward. So what's your sense of who this man is and where he's going to take the company?
Yeah, so the new CEO of McDonald's is named Steve Easterbrook. Today is his first day on the job. He's coming from running their UK operations. Mm-hmm. While I don't, I can't speak to, consumers in other parts of the world, but, what I was speaking to was sort of trends amongst, American consumers here.
Yes.
And I think the point is that, the industry, the on the production side, sort of the large meat producers, they're only going to resist to the point where their largest buyers want something different. And I think that's really the opportunity for McDonald's right now. McDonald's, in the media, it's been estimated that they purchase something like 1.5 to 2% of the beef in the country, even more chicken. They're just a tremendous, I don't think this will come as a shock to any of your listeners. They're just one of the largest buyers of meat in the country.
Yeah.
And Steve Easterbrook is now at the helm of this, enormous supply chain with a tremendous amount of leverage. And I also have seen the headlines about sales at McDonald's hurting recently.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for him and for the company right now to potentially really take on this issue. We think chicken is a great place for a company like McDonald's to start. We aren't able to know specifically about practices in a lot of these supply chains, but if McDonald's meat supply chains are similar to what typically happens in the industry, then, we know that a lot of drugs are being used in producing their meat. And so mm-hmm. there's this huge opportunity for them to, put out a policy that basically says, you have to use these drugs safely. You can only use them as they were intended, which is to treat sick animals. You can't use them routinely for non-therapeutic purposes, whether that's disease prevention or growth promotion. And, in doing that, I think not only does McDonald's have the opportunity to kind of set themselves apart from the fast food pack, but they could just, that decision could reverberate really across the industry and have a really material important impact on drug use, in the meat industry. So
yeah.
I think it's just an exciting time. I think he, from the reading I've done about him, he put in place some, exciting programs in terms of sustainable sourcing in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of hope right now that he's going to do something similar here and that he's going to really prioritize this issue, because I think people really see this as an opportunity for them to differentiate themselves.
Yeah. Well, I was fascinated when I was reading about the change in leadership at McDonald's. I went to their corporate page, and they have a tab for sustainability. And they had a really, remarkably forward-thinking statement that they published in 2003 about their sustainability goals. Now, it related mostly to cattle. And indeed, McDonald's was the entity that hired Temple Grandin to redesign their beef production, the guys that they were buying from, to reduce the stress for animals. So they've had sustainability and they've had animal welfare issues on their radar for quite a long time. And it's surprising to me that they haven't made more of an effort to market themselves as being the forward thinkers that they have been. Now, how much they enforce those, they had a whole section on antibiotic use. which was exactly what you just said, that they wanted to phase out, you know, the routine use of antibiotics for growth promotion and disease prevention, blah, blah, blah. This is back in 2007, they're saying this.
Well, it's actually 2003.
Or 2003 for that, yeah.
It's a good point. So McDonald's put out a global policy on antibiotics use in its supply chains in 2003. And
right.
at that point, I would say that was a real leadership position. You know, compared to their peers, it was really far
compared
and away.
To anyone. Nobody was talking about it then.
Yeah, more, you know, sort of comprehensive. They acknowledged this is a big public health problem. They acknowledged the role that market players like themselves, you know, have.
Right.
They put out what was really sort of a leadership policy at the time.
Right.
It prohibited the use of antibiotics for growth promotion. Around the disease prevention uses, it was more vague, and mm-hmm. You know, it's you know, it's sort of been reported already that, you know, we, you know, we've come in and we've sort of talked to them about that. We've said, you know, here's where we see the potential loopholes in your policy. Here are mm-hmm. sort of the places where you could tighten up this language to really get the biggest bang for your buck in terms
right.
of some key reforms to your policy that could reestablish you as a leader. You know, the world has sort of moved on since 2003. I think, you know, but with, you know, with some strengthening to their existing policy, they could really once again be an industry leader the way that they were in 2003. And I think that's our hope for the new CEO. I'm hoping this is at the top of his agenda. And, you know, I'll just give a quick plug. NRDC, you know, is going to have, you know, a petition basically asking him to commit to safe antibiotics use practices in his meat supply chains. And I don't know if it's up yet, but you should be able to find it, you know, hopefully later today on, I think it's nrdc.org/antibiotics. You should be mm-hmm. able to see that petition. And it's just, you know, people, you know, telling him that, you know, this is important to them. And, you know, they hope that he can make that commitment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, when I was reading that stuff, I was just blown away. And then in greenbiz.com, which is a wonderful publication, they were actually the people that turned me on to the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, of which McDonald's is a founding member.
Yep.
And this is another interesting thing. Now, they just published their criteria for sustainable beef, and it's interesting because they had to accommodate for all the different environments and
the different
ecosystems
regions, yeah.
and regions in which livestock is raised and slaughtered for, you know, meat around the world. So what works in New Zealand or Australia is not necessarily going to work in the United States and vice versa. So, I mean, there's some interesting sort of wiggle room around there. But and their antibiotic language, I thought, was very squishy. I'm sure you read that, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's not really as robust as one would hope.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I don't personally work on beef, but I'm in regular touch with my colleagues who have been following this process for
sure.
many years now. And I think, you know, from NRDC's perspective, I think the endeavor is really to be commended. They've sort of brought all these stakeholders to the table, including
yeah.
the producers, and it's really, you know, it's really important that McDonald's is there, basically putting the signal out to the marketplace, saying that, you know, we want to buy a sustainable product. I think in and of itself,
right.
that's really important and to be commended. I think, you know, there's a lot of concerns when you talk about sustainability. You know, there's concerns around, you know,
what's the definition?
Ecosystem impacts, public health impacts, social impacts. You know,
workers' rights.
Yeah, I focus on stuff. You know, antibiotics use, and I think you're right from that perspective. I think we were disappointed. I think that the guidelines around antibiotics use, while they prohibit use of antibiotics for growth promotion, they still allow them for, you know, prophylactic disease prevention.
Right.
And,
yeah.
you know, as we've sort of discussed earlier in the show,
that's,
you know,
essentially that's just a bait and switch.
Well, I don't know if it's always a bait and switch, but it's a serious concern because
sure.
you know it allows for the routine use of these antibiotics We know that that contributes to, you know, breeding antibiotic-resistant bacteria. People might have heard the word superbugs. You know, these are dangerous, yes, resistant bacteria. And we know that these bacteria, they don't stay in those livestock facilities. They escape from those facilities in lots of different ways.
Sure.
You know, on the soil and water and the air, they colonize workers. I think it's kind of creepy, but the bacteria actually can share resistant genetic traits with each other.
Yes, they do.
So what we're doing, I kind of think of it as like antibiotic resistant pollution in the environment.
That's a great way of putting it.
We're sort of, the scientific community calls it reservoirs of resistance, and I tend to think that doesn't mean anything to regular people. But so, you know, it's really just increasing that resistant pollution in our environment, and it's, you know, we know that it gets into our communities and it makes people sick. So, you know, I think from that perspective, I think that there's things to commend about the Global Roundtable, but specifically on antibiotics, I think that there's still work to be done.
Well, so people should know actually that they have just revised their criteria and they're putting them out for public comment this month. And so if you want to go to the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef website, you can read those criteria and you can register your own comments about it. And I urge everyone to take part in this because, you know, it's our food and we want what we want. And, you know, you got to let these people know what it is that you want and not expect producers to be mind readers or to make vast changes in their protocols that many of them have been using for, you know, for generations, and it's worked fine for them, and why can't we keep doing it? I mean, there's very much that mentality and that mindset, and I think it's really important to bring, you know, the consumer concerns to those producers to let them understand, because otherwise you have, and this I see a lot, is literally people saying things like, this is all part of an agenda to take meat off the plate of American citizens. I mean, we have seen this over and over again. I'm sure you've seen it too. In the trades, they're always writing. The publisher, the editor-in-chief, Mary Sukup of Drover's Cattle Network, when she was writing about the AWARE Act, which was the legislation that was introduced following Michael Moss's expose on the animal research centers, and you know what was characterized as terrible animal abuse, and she's like, "This is just all part of the agenda of, you know, HSUS and Mercy for Animals and the ASPCA to ruin our industry and take meat away from consumers." I was just like, "Mary, you want to come on the show?"
I think the message is that, you know, we want, you know, meat to be affordable and available, but also, you know, safe and healthy and responsibly produced, safe for us, for the animals, for the planet. And I think, you know, again, there are producers of, you know, lots of different sizes, from the sort of smallest scale farm to, you know, much, you know, larger production systems that, you know, show us that this can be done. And, you know, we have examples from around the world, from around the country. And so, yeah, I think the more, you know, I think the more consumers demand this, you know, we're already seeing a market response to that. I think it's really important for consumers to be really putting the responsibility at the feet of the largest buyers in the system. Companies like McDonald's have a responsibility, and, you know, they have the relationship with their consumers, and consumers have a lot of power, right? Like, we can vote with our wallets, and these big buyers will respond. But at the same time, just to kind of bring this discussion full circle, and just because we are, you know, a policy-oriented organization, you know, I don't think it's always fair to place all of the responsibility at the feet of consumers. You know, yes, it's important to vote with your wallet, but it's also important to vote with your vote. And, you know, we have a federal regulator that is responsible for protecting our health and regulating drug use in this industry. It's really important that they hear from us, that our legislators hear from us. It's not going to be enough to wait for, you know, consumers to drive all the change in this industry. You know, this is, again, a top five public health crisis. We need to move a lot more quickly. And so it's important for governments to act as well.
Nobody's going to dispute that it's important for governments to act responsibly, but they haven't. I mean, the fact is the FDA, as we discussed before, has been dragging their feet on this stuff since 1977. Which was the first time that they published a paper that said to the meat industry, you can't do this anymore. And it went nowhere. And that legislation has gone nowhere. So asking lawmakers to advocate on behalf of the public has been remarkably unsuccessful. And that's the thing that I find the most frustrating about this. We, with our tax dollars, are funding the FDA. They are grotesquely underfunded for even regulating and managing and supervising the use of antibiotics in the livestock system. They don't apparently seem to take it as seriously as a public health hazard as, you know, everyone else around the world does. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, in a way, it's like, you're right. We shouldn't expect consumers to be the ones who drive change. And yet no one else is advocating on our behalf. And that's what I think. I mean, that's why we love the Natural Resources Defense Council. Yeah, but I mean, really, it's like groups like yours. But look at, you guys sued and you won and nothing happened.
I wouldn't say nothing happened, though. I think, again,
you got the voluntary guidelines.
No, I think it brought a tremendous amount of attention to this issue. I think, as you mentioned at the top of the show, we're just seeing the media reporting on this so much more. I think all of these things are mutually reinforcing. I think, you know, when consumers go out and demand more of something, companies respond. You start seeing stories about the marketplace changing. When the marketplace changes, you know, you have companies that now have a stake in the regulations changing. And I think that, you know, more and more these things really reinforce one another. And now we're seeing efforts in states like California and Maryland to pass legislation to regulate use of these drugs. So, you know,
we can't give up yet.
Yeah, we can't just throw up our hands.
I think,
you know, change comes slowly, but all of a sudden it feels like it's moving fast here.
I agree. I do agree with that.
And so I actually think we're winning, and I think we just need to keep pushing.
Oh, my God. I just love you for that. That was the perfect end to this show. So this is Sasha Stashwick from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was great having you in the studio.
Yeah, it was
so
great
much
being
fun
here.
To have a face-to-face. And so if people want to learn more about this issue, go right to the switchboard. You've got, it's NRDC.
It's nrdc.org /antibiotics. And you can find, you know, that petition I mentioned, a lot of information about this issue and our expert blogs. You can also follow.
The expert blogs are great, by the way, people.
Thanks.
I love it.
You can also follow us at NRDC Food on Twitter.
Oh,
and we post all of our good stuff up there.
And I'll be tweeting this out. So thanks to my sponsor, Kane Winery. Thanks, Jack. And I'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening. This has been another great episode. Stay tuned for the next one.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.